This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, March 22, 2004. I'm Nell Abram. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians took to the streets today after Israeli forces assassinated the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas. Governments around the world condemn the killing. Millions rallied worldwide to protest the occupation of Iraq on the first anniversary of the invasion. And the Supreme Court heard two important cases today, a potentially landmark privacy case involving a cattle rancher who simply refused to provide police with his name. They also heard arguments in the case of a mentally challenged man in Texas who was sentenced to death. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Several hundred people with disabilities closed the entrances in front of the Department of Health and Human Services today, with some locking their wheelchairs and others lying on foam mattresses. They are demanding a meeting with Bush administration officials to discuss what they are calling the institutional discrimination in current Medicaid policies that provide funding for institutions but deny payment if someone receives the same services at home. Bob Liston is an organizer with ADAPT.
It's imperative that this administration change the way Medicaid is being provided in long-term care so that people aren't forced into institutions and nursing homes and are able to live in their own homes, their own communities, with the supports and services that they need.
The nursing home industry has been lobbying strongly against it. The bill has been stuck in Congress since the Clinton administration. Outgoing Deputy Secretary Dennis Smith said Secretary Tommy Thompson was on an overseas trip, but did put in writing that incoming Deputy Mark McClellan would meet with the advocates for rights for the differently abled as soon as he took office. Pentagon officials dropped all charges but the ones for adultery and pornography against the Muslim Army chaplain from Seattle who ministered to the prisoners being held by the U.S. government at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Martha Baskin reports.
Military authorities launched an investigation of Captain James Yee, a West Point graduate, after a series of confrontations over the treatment of Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees. Some interrogators at the U.S. Navy prison complex complained that Yee's private one-on-one meetings with inmates interfered with their attempts to fully control the prisoners. Shortly thereafter, Yee was charged with a range of accusations, including mishandling documents and viewing pornography on his computer. In dismissing the charges, Major Jeffrey D. Miller, commander of Joint Task Force Guantanamo, which operates the detention center, cited, quote, national security concerns that would arise from the release of evidence if the case proceeded. Yee's attorney, Gene Fidel.
It's preposterous. All the lawyers in this case have the necessary security clearances, and I think that the decent thing to do in the circumstances would be to apologize.
The U.S.-based Muslim and Chinese-American communities view the case against Yee as malicious harassment based on race and religion. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin.
Bush-Cheney re-election clothing supplier The Spalding Group called the inclusion of Burmese goods in its fashion line an error. A Spalding vendor says it shipped the garments before President Bush signed the Burmese Freedom and Democracy Act last September. From the Workers' Independent News Service, Sarah Turner has more.
George W. Bush's 2004 re-election campaign broke the president's own sanctions against one of the world's most repressive regimes recently, when it sold garments produced in the military dictatorship of Burma. A fleece pullover bearing the logo Bush-Cheney 04 retailed for $49.95 on the website of the campaign to re-elect the president. According to the National Labor Committee, Burmese textile workers would have to work 713 hours in order to afford a Bush-Cheney pullover.
That was Sarah Turner with the Workers' Independent News Service. Elections around the world over the weekend held both anticipated and surprising results. French socialists made significant gains by obtaining 40% of the vote, while the far right took more than 16%. Taiwan's high court is set to play a significant role in determining the fate of their elections. For now, President Sheng Shui-bian, a staunch proponent of independence from China, is claiming a narrow victory. Taiwan's stock market tumbled today as opposition members took to the streets demanding a recount. Meanwhile, in Central America, Norman Stockwell reports on election results from El Salvador.
In El Salvador yesterday, the FMLN candidate for the presidency, Shafiq Handel, was defeated by the Arena Party's Tony Saca. While the FMLN's platform of social programs in opposition to corporate globalization and privatization of basic services was probably more appealing to the majority of poor and working people in this Central American nation of 5.9 million citizens, it was a fear of a return to war and other threats that seemed to have the greatest influence in yesterday's 57% victory for ARENA, as Handel pointed out in his concession speech last night.
A vote made in fear is about without freedom.
The FMLN remains a powerful force in Salvadoran politics with 31 seats in the National Assembly and many municipal governments. The long-term effects of ARENA's victory last night are not yet known, but it is expected here that the party of the former death squads will actively push its agenda of privatization and regional free trade agreements during its coming five-year term. Reporting from San Salvador for Free Speech Radio News, this is Norman Stockwell.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Early today, Israeli forces used rocket-fired missiles launched from helicopters to assassinate Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the founder and spiritual leader of Hamas. A helicopter gunship fired on Yassin as he was pushed in his wheelchair from a mosque following morning prayers. Some 200,000 Palestinians poured into the street to decry the extrajudicial killing and march in funeral procession for the slain sheikh. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said today Sheikh Yassin was an arch-terrorist who plotted attacks that killed hundreds of Israelis. Sharon also pledged to press ahead with Israel's war on terror, signaling there will be more targeted attacks like the missile strike that killed Yassin in Gaza. The Palestinian leadership declared 3 days of mourning and has called a general strike. Ghassan Khatib is the labor minister for the Palestinian Authority. He spoke with us this afternoon from the occupied territories.
This move, Israel, is not only an illegal and can be considered as a crime, but it's also going to bring about further a spirit of revenge among Palestinians, and its only effect is going to be further deepening and widening of this ongoing vicious circle of violence.
There is some speculation that, in fact, the motivation for this assassination was less a strike against terrorism, but more a strike against the leadership of Hamas in advance of a full pullout from Gaza of the Israeli defenses, thereby leaving a position for the Palestinian Authority to move in strength in that area.
I don't think that this is the correct analysis, because according to our experiences, the more Israel will be hitting the Islamic extremist groups, the more powerful they become. And the ongoing Israeli practices has been affecting the balance of powers within the Palestinian politics and society in favor of the opposition and against the favor of the Palestinian Authority, because this is the illegal occupation. And when they strike harshly against certain political groups, this gives them legitimacy and credibility in the eyes of the majority of the Palestinian public.
International reaction worldwide has been one of condemnation. How has the Palestinian Authority synthesized that reaction, and what do you think that this global response says to the Israeli occupation forces?
Well, I think that this encouraging response by the international community at large reflects its commitment to the stipulations of the international law. However, unfortunately, the international community is stopping at just verbal criticisms and condemnation, and do not make moves that would, practically speaking, convince or pressurize Israel to stop these kind of violations to the international law and the ongoing, almost daily, killing of Palestinian people, mostly innocent civilians. We hope that this dramatic development will convince the international community, United Nations, Quartet, EU, and other powers in the world to move ahead and to invest political efforts behind some initiatives of the kind that can help us, Israelis and Palestinians, replacing the ongoing violent relations by peace negotiations relations based on the international legality, which calls for the exchange between peace and land, i.e. convincing Israel to end its illegal occupation in return for peace and security and normal relations in the region.
That was Ghassan Khatib. He's the labor minister for the Palestinian Authority, and he spoke with Free Speech Radio News this afternoon by telephone from the occupied territories. The United States Supreme Court heard arguments today about whether a Texas man sentenced to death in 1986, whose IQ is just above the mental retardation level, should receive a new trial. The court also heard arguments regarding the constitutionality of arresting detained individuals for not providing their names. Ingrid Drake from our Washington, D.C. Bureau has this Supreme Court roundup.
This morning, the Supreme Court heard the case of Robert James Tenard, who was appealing his death sentence and asking to be resentenced. Tenard was sentenced to death in 1986 by a Texas jury, which was not told it could consider the fact Tenard had an IQ test of 67, only a few points above the mental retardation line. Tenard's attorney, Robert Owen, argued the jury was not presented with the option of imposing a life sentence.
They had heard that our client has an IQ of 67, which puts him in the bottom 3% of the population in terms of his general intellectual ability. But they didn't have an instruction telling them, if you think that's a good reason to spare his life, you can do that. Instead, all they were asked were, did he behave deliberately, which wasn't defined any further than that, and a reasonable jury could think that just sort of means on purpose. And the other question they were asked was, is he dangerous? And for a lot of people for whom mental illness is an unfamiliar concept, they feel that people who suffer from cognitive impairments or mental illness are more dangerous on account of that.
The Supreme Court ruling on Tenard's case will not overrule current laws regarding death sentencing or have far-reaching impact on future legislation. Most states, including Texas, now allow juries to include mitigating factors, including cognitive capability, when making a death sentence. Robert Owen says the ruling, however, will impact several dozen capital punishment cases ruled prior to a 1991 change in Texas.
For that handful of people who were sentenced by juries that were never able to answer the straightforward question, does this person deserve to live or die, it means everything to those people because it is their only opportunity to possibly get back in front of a jury and have the jury give real consideration to the question of whether the death penalty is the appropriate punishment.
The court also heard arguments today about whether the government can force individuals to identify themselves after they've been stopped for questioning by police officers. The case in question involved a Nevada law stating individuals can face a misdemeanor charge for failing to provide their names. Petitioner to the court, Larry Heibel, was arrested in 2000 when he refused to give his name to a police officer when he was detained for questioning. Heibel, who wore a cowboy hat and boots as he sat in on the court, said the Nevada law challenged many of his constitutional rights.
Our right to remain silent, our right to not incriminate ourselves, and our right to travel freely without producing papers on demand.
The Nevada Attorney General and the U.S. Justice Department argued citizens have minimal interest in declining to give their name, while knowing suspects' names helped to assure the safety of police officers. Nibble's attorney, Robert Dolan, said his client had a significant reason for failing to give his name prior to being read his Miranda rights.
In Mr. Heibel's case, the name was a significant link in the chain of evidence against him because the underlying criminal investigation related to a possible domestic battery. And under Nevada law, one's name can reasonably be used by the trier of fact to infer that the family relationship exists, which exposes the person to greater punishment under Nevada law.
According to Dolan, 32 other states have laws similar to Nevada's, which may soon be challenged. Dolan also raised the issue of name requirements leading to the development of national identification cards. This concern was echoed by Mark Rottenberg, director of the Electronic Policy Institute, who filed an amicus brief in support of Nebold's case.
Particularly in the 21st century, post 9/11, a compelled identity requirement would have enormously harmful repercussions for privacy in America because police would have the opportunity to survey so many government databases. So in support of the Fourth and Fifth Amendment claims that were made today, we also urge the justices to consider just how sweeping surveillance would be if the Nevada statute was upheld.
Rottenberg also said there's a lot of legislation in the U.S. Congress involving identification requirements for immigration and national identification, which may be influenced by the court's decision. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake.
Today, the release of a new book by former White House counterterrorism specialist Richard Clark slams President Bush for ignoring terrorist threats before September 11th. The book release comes just before Clark testifies this week before the 9/11 Commission. Other high administration officials will also be testifying in Washington, including Secretary of State Colin Powell and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. However, there are still no arrangements for either President Bush or Vice President Dick Cheney to testify. Mitch Jeserich has more from Washington, D.C.
Richard Clark was appointed by President Ronald Reagan to head the country's counterterrorism operations. Clark also served under President Bush Sr. and President Bill Clinton, who made Clark the czar on terrorism, making him a virtual cabinet member. Clark also served for over 2 years under President George W. Bush, where he still headed the counterterrorism efforts. But he no longer met with the president along with the cabinet. The counterterrorism expert stepped down last year and on Monday released a book that slammed the Bush administration for ignoring the signs of an imminent terrorist attack before 9/11. Clark told Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes that he couldn't get a meeting with the president. Instead, he said he met with other officials who had something other than Al-Qaeda on their minds.
Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, said, no, we don't have to deal with Al-Qaeda. Why are we talking about that little guy? We have to talk about Iraqi terrorism against the United States. And I said, Paul, there hasn't been any Iraqi terrorism against the United States in 8 years.
Richard Clark also told 60 Minutes that President Bush pressured officials to find a connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq.
We were in the Situation Room complex. The president dragged me into a room with a couple of other people, shut the door, and said, I want you to find whether Iraq did this. Now, he never said, make it up. But the entire conversation left me in absolutely no doubt that George Bush wanted me to come back with a report that said Iraq did this.
His testimony is a perfect example as to why President Bush needs to make a public statement to the American public.
April Gallup is a former employee at the Defense Department who retired after receiving serious injuries in the 9/11 attack at the Pentagon. Gallup, who is a member of 9/11 families, says President Bush and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice's refusal to testify at the 9/11 Commission is unacceptable.
The 9/11 families are not out to bash the president. We think he's a very fine man as far as that go. But here's an issue that we just want to get the truth, and he is a major key to us getting to the truth.
President Bush's press secretary, Scott McClellan, defended Bush at a Monday afternoon press briefing. He said Clark's allegations were meant to garner publicity for his new book. McClellan says the Bush administration took the Al-Qaeda threat seriously from the get-go.
At the National Security Council meeting, what happened? There was a map that was unrolled on the table, and it was a map of Afghanistan. And what did the president do? The president directed that we go into Afghanistan, and we go after Al-Qaeda, and we go after and remove the Taliban from power so that Al-Qaeda would no longer have a safe harbor from which to plan and plot their attacks.
The New York Times reported that former Clinton administration officials will testify that they gave detailed information to the Bush administration, including Philip Zelikow, a member of the Bush transition team, on the dangers of Al-Qaeda. Zelikow is now the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, and his duties include trying to get information that is requested by the commission and to find the right people to testify at the hearings. Zelikow's history with the Bush administration has watchdog groups calling for his removal from the commission. Kyle Henson is the co-founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch.
He actually sat in on meetings in which Richard Clark detailed the imminent threat posed by Al-Qaeda. That puts him at the very center of the issue here, of the lack of response to an emerging threat, to a threat that we had identified as the number one threat and we had declared war against in 1997.
Clark will testify Wednesday at the 9/11 Commission hearing, taking place on Tuesday and Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Other notable witnesses include Secretary of State Colin Powell, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and former Secretary of Defense William Cohen. Pacifica Radio will have a live broadcast of the 9/11 Commission hearing both on Tuesday and Wednesday starting at 8:30 a.m. Eastern, 5:30 a.m. Pacific Time. I'm Mitch Jeserich for Free Speech Radio News.
Millions rallied worldwide on Saturday. It was the first anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. They protested the invasion and subsequent occupation of that country. Free Speech Radio News correspondents around the globe report today on some of those events. We begin in Mexico City, where a rally was held outside the U.S. Embassy. Vladimir Flores was there.
2,000 people marched in downtown Mexico City over the weekend to demand an end to the military occupation of Iraq and to condemn U.S. intervention in the domestic affairs of Venezuela, Haiti, and Cuba.
member of the Mexican chapter of Not In Their Name, Nuria Fernandez, speaks on the connection between the war and neoliberal projects like Plan Puebla Panamá and the Free Trade Area of the Americas.
Es muy fácil que la guerra se extienda a América Latina.
War could very easily extend to Latin America because here we have very important natural resources, in particular, water and biodiversity. And the wars of the future won't be about petroleum, but rather for fresh water and biodiversity. Therefore, it's very likely that in situations of this sort, even the Mexican government would permit the intervention of foreign troops into our territory.
Lesbian activists gathered to say that George Bush's war on terror is a threat to cultural diversity all over the world. Gloria Alcalá, member of Lesbianas por la Paz, explains.
Las mujeres fuimos utilizadas como argumento mediático para impulsar la guerra.
Women were used as an argument in the media to justify the war. The idea was that they were going to liberate us from inhumane treatment that the fundamentalists were dealing out to women. Today, the new Iraqi constitution, imposed by the United States, is deeply seated in fundamentalism. This is a hit against women.
The protest against the invasion of Iraq ended with a concert in front of the U.S. Embassy with cries for peace with justice and dignity from Chiapas to Baghdad. In Mexico City, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Thousands were in the streets of India. Vinod K. Jose reports from New Delhi.
India's ruling Hindu right-wing government once promised the United States to send its counter-insurgency specialist troops, Rashtriya Rifles, to Iraq. India was also expecting a huge share in the reconstruction business cake in Iraq. But thanks to the public opinion, the Indian administration was forced to back off from both the plans. The last weekend witnessed many protests across India against the US occupation in Iraq.
US troops were not welcomed as liberators. Resistance by Iraqis has been growing irrespective of Hussein's capture.
This is from a protest held in the capital city, New Delhi, by the Social Democrats and mainstream communist parties. Their main slogans were peace and withdrawal of US troops. There was another protest in the city jointly by the mass organization of the radical left and Muslim organizations. They shouted slogans supporting Iraqi guerrilla resistance. Varavara Rao of Revolutionary Writers Association.
We are supporting the resistance struggle of the Iraqi people and the Iraqi guerrilla struggle we are supporting, and we support the national liberation struggle of Iraq.
They had planned to march to the American consulate, but were arrested by the police before they could start the march. For some, it was a year-long protest and political campaign. Mass organizations of radical groups like All India People's Resistance Forum has been working in the slums and villages. For them, American invasion of Iraq was an opportunity for political education in the grassroots, and they were least interested in putting up a media event on the anniversary day. From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
In Johannesburg, South Africa, 500 to 1,000 people rallied in library gardens and marched to the Workers' Museum. Melinda Tuhus reports.
When people gathered in Johannesburg on Saturday to protest the ongoing U.S. and U.K.-sponsored war in Iraq, they had other things on their minds as well. Of equal importance was their opposition to what they call the apartheid wall that Israel is erecting on Palestinian land. Claire, a woman who participated in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, said the issue is very close to their hearts. She says she's disgusted that Israel is practicing apartheid against the Palestinians. Protesters also condemned the increasing privatization in South Africa and the role of South African corporations not only in seeking contracts for reconstruction in Iraq, but also in exploiting the resources of several African countries. They pointed to the exploitation of diamonds in Central Africa as one example. Many of those at the rally were landless peasants and poor urban dwellers. They want the government to provide them with land and free water and electricity. Jabulani Molobela of the Anti-Privatization Forum condemned what he said was intimidation of people by the ANC government to buy prepaid water meters. In effect, they will cut off their own water when they can't pay their bills. In Johannesburg, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
And Stefan Ray attended yet another rally, this one just down the street from the Western White House in Texas.
On Saturday, 700 people rallied in Crawford, Texas, as part of the Global Day of Action opposing the war on Iraq. Crawford is near George W. Bush's Texas ranch. Joining the Bring 'Em On Home march was Tony Brangia, who served in the Air Force for 38 years.
I joined the Veterans for Peace about 2 months ago, and I've been worried about which way the country was headed. Very serious problem. I think we have a fascist group that's taking power and control of the country.
Counter-demonstrators in Crawford held signs supporting Bush, but they were few in number. Longtime consumer advocate and independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader was the last speaker of the day.
What happens when you have someone in the White House who has a closed mind, suffused with a sense of messianic militarism, is a refusal to listen to the American people?
Movement troubadour David Robicks entertained the crowd with his politically inspired lyrics.
Operation Iraqi Liberation, tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation, O-I-L.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Stefan Ray in Crawford, Texas.
Argentina signed a new letter of intent with the International Monetary Fund and paid $3.1 billion in defaulted debt. Matt Goldin reports from Buenos Aires.
The deal resolved the latest in a series of tense standoffs between South America's second-largest economy and the IMF, but pressed by growing unemployment of 20% and 50% of the population in poverty, causes many locals to wonder when the reconstructions will come. Nora Cortiñas, mother of Plaza de Mayo, had this to say.
With this $3.1 billion, we can start to rehabilitate Argentina, to open factories. That way people can have jobs. That way we don't need to keep asking for money from the World Bank and from the IMF.
Argentine President Néstor Kirchner agreed to pay the debt on the condition that the IMF will guarantee re-lending Argentina the same amount. In the agreement, the IMF is said to give Argentina a three-year $13.3 billion aid agreement. Currently, Argentina is the fund's third-largest debtor after Turkey and Brazil, accounting for 15% of the IMF lending. Argentine President Néstor Kirchner, in a meeting with union leaders, said this on Wednesday.
We considered that it was very important to receive the call from the president of the IMF. And she communicated to us with a personal letter that she was in agreement with the Argentine position. That happened yesterday, and today we will send the letter to the fund.
Jorge Ceballos, leader of the Piquetero movement Barrios de Pie, was one of the many social organizations to attend last week's demonstrations.
We believe that beyond where the government goes, the important thing is the organization and the popular conscience, because what it defines always is the popular protagonism. For us, it is a problem of expectation, both in government and in certain leaders. We have confidence that sooner or later, we must start a change of this totally unjust model.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Nell Abram.